This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. It's no surprise that President Barack Obama declared the State of the Union strong during this week's State of the Union address. That's what presidents do. And by many accounts, the U.S. economy is getting stronger. But much of the president's agenda for 2015 has been declared dead on arrival by Republicans who control both legislative branches. And while the United States has officially ended more than a decade of military action in Afghanistan, concerns about unrest in the Middle East and terrorism that's born from the unrest remain major concerns. Well, these and other issues of the day are also on the mind of Western Wisconsin's 3rd District Congressman Ron Kine. The La Crosse Democrat discussed these and other topics during a recent one-on-one interview with Newsmakers senior news editor John Davis, beginning with the Veterans Administration's investigation at the Toma VA amid reports of overprescribing painkillers to veterans and a work culture of intimidation for employees who question the drugs veterans are given.
These are very serious allegations. We need to get to the bottom of it as quickly as possible. If there is a problem at Toma VA or any other VA medical center in the country, we need to be aware of it so we can take action to fix it, because the focus has got to stay on the quality of care being delivered to our veterans who earn this. They deserve it. And if problems arise, we have to have the ability to recognize them and fix it. This first came to my attention at the end of 2011 by an anonymous letter. Unfortunately, since it was anonymous, I couldn't follow up with the individual for additional questions, but I immediately forwarded that on to the Office of Inspector General, whose responsibility it is to investigate allegations of this nature. They did so in a course of a little over 2-year comprehensive investigation, not only in the pain management practice at Toma VA, but this culture that you described of possible intimidation, coercion, fear amongst the staff. And when the report came out recently, the one thing it did do is it encouraged more people with direct knowledge of what's happening there at Toma VA to come forward, contacting me and other people about information that they want to share. This can be helpful now with the announcement of a VA, formal VA investigation by Secretary McDonald, something I called for. Senator Baldwin and I followed up with him, along with the Undersecretary for Health of VA, and they agreed that the allegations are serious enough to warrant a parallel investigation, not only over the pain management practice at Toma VA, but this possible culture of intimidation and fear.
After the Office of Inspector General report came out, I believe, last year,
right,
the official line from the organization is that they do have plans in place to manage pain that hasn't been put into place, from what you know?
Well, to their credit, when the Inspector General's report came out and the OIG investigators showed up at Toma's doorstep to brief them on their findings, but also on an action plan to be implemented, you know, Toma has taken a lot of those steps. And that's why I went over there to have a meeting with the management team at Toma VA to find out what steps they are taking to address any of the deficiencies that may be happening, and a lot of the practical recommendations, I think, that came from the investigation, but also to get a better sense from them of what they're doing with the personnel problems that may exist there. And it's important that they're candid with us, that they're upfront in the communication, so we know if there are problems that need to be fixed, we can do that right away. Again, you know, with the focus on veterans care.
So what did you find out in your visit?
Well, they are implementing. They now have a separate pain management team that's in place. They separated the direct line of authority between the chief pharmacist and the chief of staff for medical purposes. They're going to a more multidisciplinary, collaborative approach to pain management, and especially the opiate dosage use there, and also willing to subject the case files to peer review, which I think is another necessary step. I'm more comfortable with a more integrated, collaborative approach to veterans care, or anyone's care for that matter. So it's not just one person's opinion that dictates the proper level of care. Even a doctor who may think they're doing the right thing could use some feedback from other healthcare professionals that are dealing with the patient as well, and be willing to listen to those recommendations and make adjustments accordingly.
The chief of staff has been temporarily reassigned.
That's correct. Yeah, he's been reassigned, so he's not at Toma now, and he's also been prohibited from dispensing any prescription medications pending the outcome of this investigation.
Have you been able to talk to vets or their families since this happened?
Yeah, you know, that too. With the report that came out in the public recently, a lot of vets have been contacting my office, and a lot of them have been saying, listen, I've been getting care and treatment at Toma VA, and I'm very happy with the attention and the quality of care that I am getting. They wanted to make sure that that story is getting out well, and I tend to agree. The vast majority of the healthcare providers at Toma VA, the veterans who are going there are pretty satisfied with the outcome of care that is given. So I don't want to be painting this picture a little too broad here. If we got a personality problem there or someone who's outside the norm of the parameters, that needs to be fixed. But I think the Toma medical staff and the center there has been doing a pretty good job in overall veteran health care.
How will this Veterans Affairs investigation be different from the investigation that was done by the Office of Inspector General?
First of all, I think there's going to be a lot more names that the investigators can go to now, those with direct knowledge of former staff people or current staff people there who are willing to talk and complete the picture of what they know taking place. But we also, since the OIG report came out in Toma, the Inspector General's office did a system-wide review and came out with a report last summer about suggestions to be implemented in all of the VA centers. That, too, is something that we can follow up with Toma to see that they're doing the same thing. You know, right or wrong, we've made a decision in this country that we don't want to see our veterans in any type of pain. But it's an inexact science, getting that right level of dosage or that right a cocktail of drugs involved, especially for veterans with both physical and mental illnesses that need to be addressed. Those are the toughest of the tough cases. Those are the ones that usually end up in our VA centers. And trying to get the right level of prescription is, I think, always going to pose a challenge because a doctor can be criticized for overprescribing, but also for underprescribing if something bad happens to that veteran. And yet I think there are being developed protocols of care and quality measurements that we can start rallying around, standards of care. And I think the pain management teams that are being established nationwide, including at Toma, could go a long ways to, in dealing with these difficulties in the future.
That Center for Investigative Reporting report indicated that one of the veterans who committed suicide was on as many as 15 different
right
medications.
Yep.
Do we fear this is a problem across the country?
It's one of the issues I raised with Secretary McDonald on how system-wide a problem this might be. And he indicated that with the OIG report that did the overall system review last year, that changes are being made, steps are being implemented, which has led to a 6-7% decline in opiate usage amongst our veterans within the last year alone. But in my conversations with other doctors who are practicing in this field within the VA system, they say oftentimes they get a veteran from the private healthcare sector who's medicated up at such a high dosage that it takes a while for them to start weaning them back down. And when they try doing it, they usually get complaints from the veteran then because they're feeling differently as a consequence. That, too, might be a problem that's not just unique to the VA system, but to the entire healthcare system when it comes to the care and the treatment that our veterans are receiving, especially as it relates to pain management.
Going to take a while to do this investigation, I assume.
Well, I tried to ask them if they had a ballpark time frame, and they didn't want to be pinned down naturally because they don't know what all they're getting into here. But they're hoping within 4 to 6 weeks they'd be able to come out with a report, whether there's actionable items dealing with personnel at Toma or more things to be implemented at Toma. Their investigation will be led by the facts and the evidence as they uncover it. But this, nevertheless, it's very troubling. And the other thing I communicated with Director DeSantis and his management team there when I was meeting with, because I showed up last year right after the Phoenix story broke to make sure that we didn't have same type of problems here in Wisconsin at Toma VA or elsewhere. And I asked them then if there were anything I need to be aware of, any problems that they're dealing with right now. And it was silence. It was quiet. You know, they were accentuating the positive and not being candid with me because they knew this investigation was going on. They knew there was a personnel issue in there. And I told them, listen, if we're going to fix this, you've got to be upfront and candid. And you can't be seen as trying to hide the ball because that doesn't look good for anyone then.
Is there anything else you want to add about the Toma VA?
Well, Toma VA did issue a statement about the steps that they have taken, you know, which I applaud them for doing. And this happened last year even. But they also welcomed the new VA investigation that was announced. They want to bring them in. They want to clear the air on all of this stuff. And if there are areas of improvement, they seem to be fully amenable to that. But again, I just want to emphasize that there is, I think, a lot of good quality care happening at TOMA. But these allegations are very serious, especially within the last couple of weeks when I've had a lot more people contacting my office and people who are willing to step up and talk to investigative teams.
President Obama gave his State of the Union address this week, and among the ideas that he wants to pursue are things like free 2 years of community college for folks working to deal with cybercrime and expanding broadband. How realistic are some of these ideas given the political environment in Washington?
You know, I'm hopeful that there's an opportunity for some common ground to be had here. I've always had this theory that politics gets ugly when the economy gets ugly. And when we had that Great Recession and everyone was living in fear about where this economy was taking us, that was reflective in the political system. And you had intense polarization, hyper-partisanship. And we had to deal and try to govern in that period of crisis. Now we're starting to see a strength of an economic recovery happening with jobs being created. We had the strongest year for private sector job growth last year since 1999. And for those of us who are old enough to remember the booming 90s, that was a good period of strong growth, budget surpluses, and there was a little bit more of an effort for bipartisan agreement. So I'm hoping we may have a chance to govern in a period of economic growth and work on being a real partner with the private sector rather than a hindrance to the type of growth and job creation that we need. And I think some of the themes that the president's already out talking about, trying to make K through 14 the goal in this country, not just K through 12 for free education, especially as it relates to our tech and vocational education schools, so we can do a better job of matching up the skills that our employers need in the community with good paying jobs, you know, for our students. There will be a premium on higher education with the jobs being created in the future. So I'm glad the president's focused on that. He also talks about wise choices that we can make to reduce federal spending in the federal budget, because there are still a lot of waste and inefficient programs. Weapon systems, for instance, that the Pentagon keeps telling Congress stop appropriating money for because we don't want them and we don't need them. And yet Congress continues to appropriate money. There are areas of major cost savings that we can work on so we can maybe free up some more resources in human capital investment, quality education, job training programs, broadband expansion, infrastructure modernization, basic research funding, especially in life sciences and technology, which can lead to new discoveries and breakthroughs. We need to have the wisdom to know where there's wasteful spending occurring and where there are wise investments to be made.
What would, for example, broadband expansion mean for the business climate in the 3rd District?
3rd District is a very large rural area, and I'm concerned that there are pockets of no broadband access, especially high-speed internet access. If you don't have that in today's 21st century global economy, it's going to be awfully tough to attract new businesses in the area, and it will be impossible to keep young people there. They want to go where the internet is, where the broadband is. It's a new appendage that they grew on themselves. So it's important that we recognize the difficulty of that last mile build-out, it's called, and the expense in doing it. And that's why, again, the president was down in Iowa talking about enabling local communities, giving them the chance to build out their own fiber optic network, so we're just not dominated by two large, powerful cable companies trying to establish monopolistic control over all this broadband access out there. Because unfortunately, there's been a trend in the state legislatures to prohibit local communities from doing it, which I think is crazy. We ought to have more competition, which can help bring prices down and make it more affordable to your typical consumer rather than being captive to just two major cable companies.
So you've been in Congress in good times and bad. What do you think the state of the nation is?
You know, I think when you look at us in comparison to the rest of the world, there is no comparison. We're doing laps around the rest of the world when it comes to economic growth. And that doesn't mean everyone's benefited from it. We still have tepid wage growth. And that usually is, John, one of the last things to recover in a deep recession, especially a financial recession that we're coming out of. Wage growth is usually the last. I'm expecting stronger and healthier wage growth for working families this year. We're facing an energy boom. I mean, who would have predicted 6 months ago that oil at 108 would be down to 44 bucks today, and we'd be paying 194 at the service pumps here in La Crosse? That, too, is going to be a tremendous stimulus with more people, more money in people's pockets so they can go out and support the local economy. 70% of this economy is consumer-driven, and so that is an incredible dynamic. But it doesn't mean that we're done. There's still a lot of work we need to do. And I still think education is a great equalizer. We ought to be making it easier and more affordable for our kids to go on to school so that they're not saddled with a lifetime of student debt. It's been a major point of focus that I've had. And I'm worried about the typical undergrad in Wisconsin coming out with $28,000 worth of debt just as they're starting a job, maybe trying to buy their first home or car, or start their family. You know, that is a burden that we can do something about. And there are practical solutions, and I'm hoping it's another area of bipartisan cooperation.
This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. Today we are talking about a variety of issues with the Wisconsin 3rd District Congressman Ron Kind, a Democrat from La Crosse. I wanted your thoughts on fighting terrorism. We're at a time now where the U.S. is withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. There are reports of more recruiting going on in Afghanistan of terrorists. We have, of course, the killings at the French magazine, Charlie Hebdo. Terrorism around the world does not seem to be slowing down at all. How would you describe the U.S. policy in response to terrorism?
I think there's certainly enhanced vigilance since 9/11, since the attacks on U.S. soil. But it's been a work in progress, and we are learning as we are going of how to develop more secure and more efficient intelligence networks to get us information to prevent terrorist attacks to begin with, while still trying to balance that against the constitutional rights and privacy interests of U.S. citizens. And there's going to be that tension of collecting more intel across the globe while maintaining those privacy safeguards for U.S. citizens. And that is a healthy debate that we ought to be having over and over again. But we can't do this by ourselves. We're going to need the help within the international community and the collaboration that can stem from that, from multiple intelligence actions and work on the ground in order to contain and then start to degrade some of the more dangerous terrorist groups that exist out there. But the real key to this, John, it's not in the West. It's with the moderate voices in the Muslim world. They have to be willing to start stepping up and denouncing these terrorist attacks, which is not a part of Islam. It is not a part of the Quran. And that education process needs to sweep the Muslim world right now. We can't do it. They're not going to listen to us. Only those moderate Muslim voices can start turning the tide in that regard.
So you don't believe the U.S. needs to be involved in trying to reform?
Well, there is a role, and we're there right now. But I don't want to see another prolonged, entrenched military engagement in the Middle East coming out of two very long and costly wars already. Nor do I think the American people want to see us do that. And we're not going to win this battle with boots on the ground. It's going to be a much more sophisticated campaign of how we can isolate these terrorists and discredit them is what needs to happen in the international world, especially with young Muslims throughout the world. And yet they are a serious threat out there that we have to treat seriously to ensure that they do not develop global reach or the ability to come and attack us or go after U.S. citizens. And we're seeing now with the recent attacks in France how that has galvanized the international community to start standing up with one voice and to denounce it and start putting together long-term plans of how to counter it.
As we retreat from places like Afghanistan, and if the reports of recruitment increasing are true, should we prepare for a time when we're going to see more of these isolated terrorist incidents and maybe some on our own soil?
Well, let's hope there's none on our soil, and we're doing the best we can through proper intelligence safeguards and working with our allies to prevent that, to get out ahead of that, and knock on wood. We've been relatively successful in thwarting possible plans against the U.S. on U.S. soil, but it's such an asymmetrical situation. You know, it's like gang warfare out there. It's hard for local law enforcement to get on top of all the gang activity and the random violence and shooting that happens. And we see that also within the terrorist world, too. because it just takes a small group with some weapons to go out and wreak havoc at some newspaper or some deli in someone's community, and that constitutes a terrorist act. And so there has to be, I think, a global approach and a global strategy to it. But I'm also convinced that we can't do this for them in Iraq, in Afghanistan. They've got to determine what type of future they want to create, especially for their children. And I'm afraid that until they start loving their children more than they hate each other in the region, we're going to see this cycle of violence continue for a while.
We have seen in our country a ramping up of tension between police and people of color.
Right.
6 years into President Obama's presidency, where are we at with race in this country?
You know, there's certainly been progress made. You look at the advancement of the civil rights and the human rights bills of the 60s and the acceptance of diversity in our community, but we're not there yet. And we need to not be afraid of having these conversations. If there are problems, how can we address them working together? And sometimes it's subconscious. Sometimes people aren't aware that there's a perception problem even. I think we're seeing this in law enforcement activities affecting especially the African-American community. You look at the surveys, and it's like we live on two different planets between white families and black families and how they perceive law enforcement in their lives. That's a problem, and it needs to be addressed. But I also know as a former prosecutor that our law enforcement, they go out and they face some very difficult judgments every day. You know, they're trying to make the community safer. They're trying to keep themselves safe, too. And the decisions that they have to make with the advantage of hindsight may not always be clear at the time when it's happening. And I think we need to be respectful of what law enforcement is going through as well, ensuring that they're getting the training that they need, but also understanding that there are difficulties in various communities right now in the approach to law enforcement.
Republicans are troubled by President Obama's use of executive privilege and want to find a way to rein it in. Do you think it's been excessive?
Well,
how does it compare to what other presidents
have done? You just compare it data-wise, fact-wise, he still lags George W. Bush when it comes to the issuance of executive orders. And in fact, he lags behind President Bill Clinton. And I've typically found that the party that doesn't have the White House is oftentimes critical of a president exercising his executive authority when they disagree with that policy. If they agree with it, you don't hear word one, you know. And so I think you got to take it with that understanding involved. But and let's take the example of the immigration executive orders that President Obama just issued. The major one doesn't take effect until June 1. If the Republican Party has a problem with what the president is doing, they can fix it themselves and come up with a solution way before June 1, but they are unwilling or incapable of doing it. So their only play that they have is to criticize a president who has grown disenchanted with the lack of work product coming out of this Congress and wants to do something to try to start fixing an immigration system that's broken. And everyone knows it's broken, and it needs some major changes and revisions to it. So if Congress wants to act as a partner to try to fix a broken system, I think they're going to find a willing hand down Pennsylvania Avenue to work with. But if all they're going to do is sit back and criticize, unfortunately, the president's going to want to try to get something done in the final 2 years of office, and he's not going to wait around forever.
What have you noticed now that Republicans are in control of the House and the Senate?
Well, I hope they understand that with power comes responsibility. They're in the majority, and they have the responsibility now to govern and to get things done. You know, when they didn't, they could sit back and be naysayers, say no to everything, and just criticize. And it may work for short-term politics. But as far as a long-term governing strategy and to convince people that they have the right ideas for the future of all of us, they got to start producing some things. So I'm still hopeful that there may be some areas that they're willing to cooperate on to get things done because we have divided government. We still have a president that has to sign these bills or not. But the first couple of weeks certainly doesn't lend to that hope because all they're doing now is bringing up past bills that they know the president objects to, who said that he'll veto them, and yet we're spinning our wheels, going through the time to pass these bills again to see if they've got 60 votes in the Senate and then expecting a presidential veto that they know they're not going to override. And I just feel like we're wasting a lot of time. Let's instead focus on those areas where there can be some agreement and start talking to each other and build those areas of trust so maybe we can find some common ground.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with Wisconsin 3rd District Congressman Ron Kind about a wide variety of issues. He is a Democrat from La Crosse. 20 years now in Congress?
Yeah, this is the start of my 19th year.
19th year
in Congress,
year.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, goes fast.
So we've seen recent reports about problems with rail bridge safety. We know our roads and our bridges could use some help.
Absolutely.
What are we going to do? And will the federal government, do you think, be involved in improving our infrastructure in this?
Yeah, it's exactly why
nation.
I brought Secretary Anthony Fox here to the La Crosse community last August, so we could have a community-wide discussion with the Transportation Secretary where we need to go with our infrastructure needs as a nation. And also, we set up a separate rail safety meeting with him, too, because there's a direct role that Surface Transportation Board out of the Department of Transportation can play of ensuring rail safety, bridge safety, more inspections, and making sure that the railroads are doing with the system upgrades that they need to be doing. And we got to continue to stay focused. I'm very worried about the increase in the Bakken oil flowing through our communities. They are very toxic, highly volatile, flammable. We've seen derailments in this country in the course of the last couple of years. I do not want to see another major accident anywhere, let alone here in western Wisconsin. That's become a corridor for the shipment of this. I was pleased, however, that North Dakota moved forward on a destabilizing agent to remove some of the more toxic and flammable chemicals. I was an advocate early on for doing it. It's an inexpensive process. Texas was doing it with their oil already. We should have been doing it a long time ago, and they're starting to move forward with it. But this is another area, John, I'm hopeful that the parties will be able to reach some common ground on. I mean, we all know that we have a deteriorating infrastructure system. The problem has been reaching consensus on what a sustainable revenue source will be for our infrastructure needs. Historically, it's been based on the gas tax, 18.3 cents at the pump. That hasn't kept pace with the need nor the technology of fuel-efficient cars, electronic cars. People are consuming a lot less gas today, so we're not raising the amount of revenue that's needed to take care of our infrastructure system. So I called on my colleague, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, who's now chairing the Ways and Means Committee on which I sit. Let's start having some hearings. Let's start having some discussions about this. Let's find out where the options are and where there might be some areas of agreement that we can move forward on. For whatever reason, the Republican Congress is refusing even to have hearings on this stuff, which I don't understand. And yet the stuff continues to deteriorate, and when we do come around to fixing it, it's going to be a lot more expensive than in the future.
You've been involved quite heavily over the years with the Mississippi River.
Right.
And is there anything with the river to improve the health of the river?
Yeah, there is, and I'm going to remain focused, too, on the proper management of this incredibly valuable and beautiful natural resource that we're blessed to have right in our backyard, the Mississippi River Basin. And that's why I'm co-chairing the Mississippi River Caucus. We're getting bipartisan participation in that caucus, too, because we're all in this together. I mean, it's everything west of the Appalachians and east of the Rockies that we're talking about. And yet there, you look at the infrastructure needs on the river, the lock and dam system. These are 1930 systems that are in desperate need of an upgrade. And that, too, is not getting done right now. Or the ecosystem management along the river, whether it's island degradation or the sediment flows going into the river that does most of the damage. There are steps that we can be taken at the federal, state, and local level, along with the private sector, so we have a better management plan for basin management. There are tools in the Farm Bill, for instance, under the conservation title, working with farmers to reduce sediment nutrient flows off their land to improve the quality of water. I was proud that a couple of bills that I authored last session of Congress were enacted into law late last year. One is permanent e-duck stamp so that duck hunters are able to purchase their duck stamps on the internet. The funds collected from that go into refuge management and watershed protection programs. And then we were able to increase the cost of the duck stamp from $15 to $25, which the duck hunting community was calling for. Because, again, that money went into wetlands preservation and projects to enhance the quality of water that we have. So there's more work that needs to be done. We ought not take these resources for granted. And we have to always stay diligent to make sure that they're being managed appropriately. And that's why, I'm going to continue my focus on the river that we have.
agriculture is such a big livelihood in the 3rd District. And I think farmers are doing pretty well right now.
Yeah, we have been fortunate the last couple of years with higher commodity prices. We saw corn and soybean come down last year. Milk now is starting to plummet. It's roughly $16 where it was about $24, $25 last year. So things are going to get tight again for our dairy farmers. But that's typically the cycle we see, that when milk prices go up, they tend to ramp up production, and you get oversupply in the marketplace, and that leads to a decline in price. But one thing, too, that is kind of unheralded, but that I noticed, in the last couple of years, we've had a 25% increase in dairy exports coming from Wisconsin. That, too, has helped stabilize prices. And that's why I think having a robust and fair trade agenda is important for our country, for our businesses, for our farmers, for our workers. And I've been heavily involved in the negotiations of this Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, making sure that we reach a good agreement for American workers and businesses, and that we begin to level the playing field so that our workers and businesses can compete effectively in the global marketplace. I sometimes take criticism back home for my support of some of these trade initiatives, but the truth is, John, we're 4% of the world's population. Of course we're going to be trading. The only real issue is, what are the rules of trade going to look like? And we have a choice to make. We could have a trading system with no rules, with China's rules, or with our rules. That's it. And for those who are criticizing these trade negotiations, I ask them, will you be happier then with no rules at all in global trade? That will be a race to the bottom that we can't compete in. Or will you be happy with China's rules? Because China would love nothing better than to step in this vacuum and establish the global trading rule system themselves. I would submit that that's not in our best long-term interest. So, of course, we've got to be at the table. We've got to be pushing for core international labor and environmental standards, fully enforceable like any other provision in it. Got to make sure that there's food safety concerns being addressed, that internet privacy concerns and cross-border data transmission is being addressed, and that we have greater market access to other countries than what we have today. Because the truth is, they've got pretty much unlimited access to our country today. We're trying to level the playing field so it's a little easier for us to ship our products, our food, the things that we make here in the United States to other markets. But if we don't move forward on these trade agreements, we're in essence encouraging our companies to move to those countries then, because then they don't have to deal with the trade barriers that do exist because they're there already. That's not what we should be encouraging. We've got to be encouraging good-paying jobs here at home.
We finally got that long overdue farm bill last year. Is there anything else that agriculture needs that is outside of the Farm Bill?
Well, I'm following the implementation of the Farm Bill. We've got a new insurance program, too. We're seeing how well that works. I think in some aspects it was way too generous. We've got major agribusinesses receiving a bulk of the premium subsidies for the insurance they're taking out. And in light of the budget deficits, that's irresponsible. We also had a consolidation of many of the conservation programs in the Farm Bill. I want to make sure that they're being worked on effectively and that we're learning from it. We also have a new beginning farmer program as part of the Farm Bill, and that's crucial for that next generation to step up and start taking over farming operations so we can keep it going. So there's a lot of pieces to the Farm Bill that we've got to continue to monitor and make sure that it's working well. I was especially proud of the organic title. For years, organic farmers kind of got left to the wayside when it came to these farm bills. But now there's an increase in funding for organic research, organic transition programs, for instance, labeling programs. So we work very closely with Organic Valley and a lot of our organic farmers in the area to make sure that they had a seat at the table and that their voices were being heard too.
What are your goals for the next 2 years?
I want to stay focused on what we can do to strengthen and expand the middle class. The middle class has been hit, and they've been squeezed. The wage growth hasn't been there. Other expenses are going up for them. It just seems to be getting harder and harder to make ends meet. The concern about sending a child on to higher education and the expenses there. The cost shift that is now occurring within the healthcare system. Most of us still get our healthcare through our employer. And yet the employers out there have, over the last couple of decades, like they did with pensions, starting to shift the cost of healthcare onto their employees through high deductible plans, more out-of-pocket, more co-pays, even though the overall spending per person in healthcare has been relatively stable at the lowest level in 60 years. But the average family doesn't feel that because they're paying more with the insurance premiums just to have healthcare in their life. So I think we've got to stay focused on what we can do to grow and strengthen the middle class, which is, I think, the backbone and the strength of our country. And there are just too many families who are still struggling too much.
Is there anything else you want to add, Ron?
Yeah, I think we need an innovation agenda. I think there are smart human investments we should be making that are being cut right now, and it will be a recipe for the decline of the United States. We will no longer remain the most innovative and competitive and creative nation in the world if we continue to underfund education in our country, continue to underfund job training opportunities or that basic research or the broadband expansion that we need. You know, we've been fortunate because of some wise investments that were made before us that set us up for success. But now there's this prevailing attitude in Washington, cut here, cut now, cut everything, regardless of the consequences. And there's no discrimination between bad spending programs and the type of investments we do need to make. I think that's going to be a crucial issue to be resolved here in the next couple of years for our country, and whether or not we're going to stay on the cutting edge of new breakthroughs and new discoveries, and whether we can continue to promise our children that tomorrow is going to look better than yesterday.
Wisconsin's 3rd District Congressman Ron Kind. The La Crosse Democrats spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about many of the issues of the day, including terrorism, the economy, and an investigation into over-medicating veterans and problems with the work environment at the Toma VA. When we return, we'll learn about how the city of La Crosse deals with sledding in its parks. The discussion comes as many communities are backing away from sledding as people who get hurt are suing and winning large jury verdicts. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Archives of today's show can be found at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to a report that launched the most recent investigation into overmedication at the Toma VA and stories from Wisconsin Public Radio that have addressed the issue. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Sledding, or rather limiting sledding, has been making headlines recently as some Midwestern communities are curtailing sledding in public parks because of concerns for personal injury, liability, and lawsuits. Multimillion-dollar jury verdicts in places like Boone and Sioux City, Iowa, have led to sledding bans in public parks in places like Dubuque and Des Moines, Iowa, and in Omaha, Nebraska. The city of La Crosse is actually hosting 3 hours of public sledding later this month as part of its annual Winter Rec Fest, which had us wondering about city concerns for liability. La Crosse Parks and Recreation Coordinator Adam Young spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about the city's approach to sledding in parks and the issue of liability if anyone gets hurt doing anything in a public park in La Crosse.
It's obviously a very fun activity for the youth and adults in our community to participate in. So any recreation activity that, you know, is going on in our city, we like to be involved in. Having said that, I want to just make a point that winter sledding, we really have no designated areas for winter sledding in city parks. That's not to say that they can participate in it. You know, we're not saying that they can't do that. But just to make a case in point, there is no designated sledding hills within City of La Crosse Parks and Recreation.
What is the effect of that? You can't tell people don't sled in city parks, but you're not endorsing it either.
Correct. It's more of just a safety issue, you know, liability-wise, without having any, you know, set staff, a schedule, you know, a designated area for kids and families to sled on, you know, makes it a big issue for us to look into. Yep.
I assume it would be a lot like swimming would be in the summer. I mean, the city has swimming pools. You provide lifeguards.
Absolutely. You know, with a I should say, you know, a designated sledding hill. You would have to have staff, certain safety measures that are in place, liability factors, and all that.
Have you looked at what's going on in Iowa, in particular, where a lot of places are facing multimillion-dollar lawsuits from people who get hurt?
And this is a perfect example of a case like that where we do not have a set sledding hill in place within our parks.
How many parks does the city of La Crosse have?
Well over 20, I know that.
For the most part, I think they're pretty flat, although there are some parks with small hills.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Myrick Park is a good example of, you know, a more hillier park in our town. Maybe Red Cloud Park, you know, they have some areas where it could be family friendly for the youngsters around to go and enjoy, you know, sledding.
During Winter Rec Fest, there's often a sledding event, I guess, snow permitting.
Absolutely.
Once again this year, La Crosse is sponsoring a sledding event?
Yeah, we do. It's our family fun night next Friday, January 30th. It's our annual family fun night where we do have a sledding hill as part of our event. In this case for us, we do take certain measures to, you know, enforce safety, such as, you know, having floodlights out there to make sure everything is lit up. We have several of our staff that is on duty out there to ensure that, you know, safety measures are in place. We obviously have designated sledding lanes with staff up on top of the hill to make sure we have a set time and to make sure that the lane is open for the next kid or adult to go down the hill. So,
has that been a pretty safe event?
It's been very safe. For as long as I have been here, we've had no injuries whatsoever. The main point for that is for how many staff that we have out there and the certain safety measures that we go through to ensure that we do not have any injuries.
Sledding is a tough thing because you can fall off and hurt yourself in many different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, I feel like, you know, the kids that are coming out, they've been down the hills here and there. They kind of know what our event entails on our family fun night. So we take that extra step to make sure that we avoid any injuries.
The Forest Hills Hill, if I recall, is fairly challenging, isn't it?
It's one of the steeper hills around town. That's one of the reasons why we do our sledding hill up at the golf course. You know, back when we had the clubhouse up there, it was a fairly larger event, but we're trying to, you know, encourage everybody to still come out. We still do the hot chocolate, the snowshoe trails provided by, you know, Three Rivers Outdoors. Of course, it's all lighted, and we also do a firework display at the end of the night. So it's a great event for, you know, families to come out and enjoy, you know, the winter.
Is a lack of snow going to be an issue for Rec Fest this year?
It will for that event, definitely. You know, we're going to need snow to do our snow events. Sledding, main reason. We have the cross-country ski trails and the snowshoe trails that we light up. You know, if we have no snow, they can't participate in those activities. So we're hoping for snow.
Is it something where the city would consider trucking in snow from somewhere?
You know, we have considered that in the past. Obviously, we've ran into this situation before. It's a bigger issue than just bringing in snow from, you know, from the streets, you know, things like that. We've considered actually bringing in a snowmaker, but, you know, financials involved in that, you know, maybe they weren't in place at the time, but we've always considered doing that as a absolute resource to keep the event going.
What about liability for any types of recreational events in city parks? Yeah, the Hickson Forest, for example, I believe that's a city park, is it not?
It is.
I know that's popular for cross-country skiing and snowshoeing and running and mountain biking. And
one of the main points as far as liability goes is that if they are signed up in a Parks and Recreation program, they would be covered. If it is a non-sanctioned Parks and Recreation event or program, they would be considered under their own liability for their actions.
The city doesn't post signs, does it? But I'm sure it has policies somewhere.
We do have policies. Obviously, you know, this is all stated in the municipal code book. It's laid out very clearly the liability issues that come into place in our programs. That is a very good resource for people who are interested to get a better understanding of the municipal codes to go there and look before maybe they participate in their activities that they enjoy.
I know the city has hundreds of programs for youth and adults alike during the given year. I don't know if you've ever taken a look at just how safe these programs are.
Oh, absolutely.
Do a lot of people get hurt in a given year?
Very rarely. You get your scratches, your bruises, maybe a potential baseball in the eye, you know, things like that. Where, you know, these situations are covered clearly in our waiver for all of our programs. And everybody does have to sign this to be involved in our programs. So there's always that factor that comes into play in recreation activities, you know. But to answer the question, very rarely do we receive any major injury to any participants.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about Wreckfest, if we could. This is the 29th year for Wreckfest?
Yes.
What are some of the big events that people enjoy participating in or being a spectator for?
There is a ton of people that enjoy hunting for the medallion. We've been around a long time for these hunts, and people do enjoy it for the reason to get outside, but also there's a money factor involved. $500 for the person who finds it, and to be clear, they must have a Winter Rec Fest button in order to receive the $500. Moving on to some of the bigger events, you know, coming up is the adult rec sports. This upcoming Saturday, we have the kickball tournament, our broomball tournament, the softball tournament. These are all well attended by adults in our town, as well as the volleyball tournament up at Alpine Inn and Nutbush. Very well attended every year. They enjoy going out, you know, having a good time in the snow. It's something different than their, you know, regular summer league, winter league indoors. You know, it's that whole winter participation thing, you know, trying to get us outside. Those are well attended always. Coming at the going on to the youth side, we have hosted our youth basketball tournament with the Onalaska Parks and Recreation Department. That's always been well attended with our youth basketball players around town. And we also have our youth Mite Jamboree hockey tournament that's coming up on the 31st as well. Very well attended event, I should say, is our figure skating exhibition. We get a lot of participants that come out to, you know, showcase what they've been working on all winter, and a lot of families come out to enjoy that. It's a great event. It's coming up this Friday, the 23rd, down at the Green Island Ice Arena. In order to participate in any of the events, you do have to have a Winter Rec Fest button. They are $2, and they support our Youth Enrichment Association. We've had our Family Fun Night in place for several years. That's a well-tended event. Anybody can come out and enjoy that. There's no pre-registration whatsoever. If you're looking at getting a button that night, you can just stop on up to Forest Hills, and you can purchase that on site. It's a great night for the kids, for the family, especially when, you know, Skyrockers has their firework display at the end to basically, you know, wrap up the night. We have our card tournament the following day. If you're a avid Euchre Sheep's Head player, this is a great time to, you know, come out and showcase your skills, I should say. Both weekends, we have a couple events where there requires no pre-registration. For instance, coming up this Saturday, the 24th, we have our Winter Rec Fest Fishing Derby out at Pettibone Park in the Lagoon. Anybody can show up that day. It's obviously for the youth, but adults are more than welcome to be out there with their kids. This is a great time for them to come out and just enjoy the weather, enjoy some ice fishing. It's going to be from 9 to 11 on Saturday the 24th, and again, requires zero pre-registration. The following weekend, we have our family fun night on Friday the 30th. Again, zero pre-registration required. You can show up that night and enjoy the activities that we provide.
Adam Young is La Crosse Parks and Recreation's coordinator. He spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. You can find a link to more details about the schedule and activities taking place during La Crosse's 29th Winter Rec Fest at our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. And for this week, that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Our production team includes Maureen McCollum, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at WPR.org/newsmakers, where you can also find links to archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, we welcome those suggestions. You can find links to our producers and staff, that and more, all at WPR.org/newsmakers. And for updates on future shows, links to our archives and more, you can also like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.